Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702 for the curious on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show, brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank, good evening. Welcome to The Money Show this Friday night. It's been an astonishingly busy Friday, actually. Most Fridays, you get one or two little announcements, none of them particularly interesting, but boy, lots of big stories today, including the billion rand which South African Airways has to pay to Comair for anti-competitive behaviour. 14-year case finally being settled. We'll get some analysis on that this evening. We'll find out why Baskin and Robbins and Dunkin' Donuts have crashed and burned, and why they're going to be leaving the country. Plus, we'll look at some pretty big stories around today's market activity, the trading updates that came out, the good, the bad, and the quite ugly in some cases.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7.
And thanks to the company that operates FM. Burger King, Baskin and Robbins and Dunkin' Donuts is going to get out of two of those businesses. Grand Parade Investments, which was a real money spinner for investors when it was primarily a manufacturer of gambling equipment and a player in the casino industry, moved into the fast food sector and has, well, yeah, burned its fingers. The acting chief executive, Mohsen Tajbakhsh, is with us on the line just from Cape Town tonight. Mohsen, tell me why Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin Robbins have got to be sent home.
Good evening, Bruce. Good evening to your listeners. Thanks for having me on your show. I think it's a long time coming. Last year, we slowed down the rollout of Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin Robbins to focus on improving the profitability of the two brands. And, you know, we weren't getting anywhere. It was a little bit difficult to penetrate the South African market. We launched a premium product in a failing economy with a highly indebted consumer, failing retail sector. And it was just really, really difficult to get these brands off the ground, really difficult to get the stores to profitability at store level. And in September, you know, we decided that we wanted to exit the brands, and we investigated, or we ran a due diligence process with a few potential buyers. But we didn't get any serious offers, and you know, hence the board has decided to actually voluntarily liquidate these businesses.
Aren't you tied up in knots in terms of contracts with the owners of Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin Robbins?
Yeah, we've got a franchise agreement, and we've kept them abreast with the developments. It's now for us to actually just sit down and negotiate a mutual termination of the agreement.
They're not interested in continuing directly themselves. They require a local partner, do they?
They're not interested in operating. We have suggested this to them. We spoke to them and suggested this. And I think when we went to them the first time, they actually introduced us to one of the potential buyers. And there may still be an opportunity, you know, with this buyer to actually still continue the brand. But they were just not happy with the assets that we had.
And then you've got staff, you've got premises. You'll have long-term leases on some of these shops, and you've got people who work for you, anticipating the next couple of paychecks. How's that going to play out?
Yes, yeah. So one of the things that we are doing is to negotiate with landowners, and to try and settle some of those lease agreements. I've already been in contact with several of our landlords, and that those negotiations are going quite well. With regards to the staff, we are trying to move staff around into the head office as well as into Burger King, where we are developing new stores. And also what we've done is we've prioritized some of the staff and put them on a list. And whenever there's new stores that are being opened in Cape Town, you know, we'll probably look to those staff before we look anywhere else.
I mean, is the brutal reality of these multinational brands, I mean, really top-end brands like Baskin Robbins, less so, but still Dunkin' Donuts in the luxury sort of space. We've seen it with Domino's Pizza. We've seen it with Starbucks corroding the value of taste holdings. That the royalties in these things are just so blimmin' high, it's very hard for the franchisor to make any sort of margin in South Africa.
Yes, I think, the royalties coupled with, the stringent requirements from the partners with regards to equipment and store layouts and the size of the stores, you know, it makes it difficult to make any money. I mean, we were spending, over 2.5 million rand a store to actually, spit out a Baskin Robbins or Dunkin' Donuts store. And yeah, it requires a lot of capital to be able to roll out these brands, and it requires, you know, good market penetration to be able to generate enough revenue to make those brands work.
So what are your time frames? When is the last best scoop of Baskin Robbins delivered in South Africa?
So I think fans will have probably about 2 to 3 weeks to get their last fix of donuts and ice cream. And then depending on our, you know, discussions with the liquidator, we probably will close doors within 2 to 3 weeks.
I mean, that's pretty quick. I mean, you've clearly decided that this is not, you're not going to keep losing money like this. What does it mean for the future of international brands into South Africa from a Grand Parade perspective? I mean, you came with Burger King that, you know, had a slow start, and you've now got good traction with Burger King, and you're persisting with Burger King. But the fact that you've had to admit defeat on Dunkin' Donuts and Baskin Robbins, does it make you frightened for the future of bringing in more brands?
Yeah, I don't think we are going to be looking at bringing in any international brands. I think we've paid our school fees with Burger King, and I think we got it to a point where it's doing really well. We are opening really, really good quality stores, and we want to focus our capital in terms of growing Burger King. But I mean, not only that, I mean, we've also been, you know, closing some of the Burger King stores that haven't been doing too well, while growing at the same time as well. So ultimately, we're looking to improve profitability and grow the brand. And I think, you know, we've got our hands full, and we want to focus on growing Burger King. And ultimately, I think GPI had its success as an investment company. Ultimately, I think the future for GPI lies in being an empowerment investment holding company.
My thanks to Mohsen Tajbai, the acting chief executive of Grand Parade Investments. They've been through lots of chief executives in recent months, last year or so. I think he must be the third. And, big shareholder activism. And there's been a lot of pushback against the expansion of this business into markets that simply weren't working anymore.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live, online, smartphones, DSTV, and 92.7.
If something that could be tarted up as being a victory for the little guy, it can also be, if you look at the other side of the coin, a blow for taxpayers. It's frankly a bit of both, because Comair has won its 14-year battle with SAA for compensation after the national carrier's dodgy incentive scheme. It was basically giving incentives to travel agents to prioritize sales of SAA tickets over other airlines. And SAA has got to pay Comair over R1 billion over the next 3 years. Guy Leach is the managing editor of SA Flyer magazine. There's not exactly petty cash available, Guy Leach, for SAA to pay Comair over 3 years, is there?
Yeah, hi, Bruce. Nice to be with you. Indeed. I mean, I think it's significant that SAA agreed to the settlement with Comair. Obviously, as you've mentioned, it's been going on for ages, so it doesn't bring the comfort of an element of finality to it. But SAA's currently in a tight cash position, and is indeed faced with 9.5 billion rands worth of debt it's got to replace in the next 2 months. Look, fortunately, this particular award is for the 1.16 billion. It has to only be paid back by 2022, but that's only 3 years' time. In the meanwhile, SAA is still living a very hand-to-mouth existence, and as you say, I'm appealing to the taxpayers for operating capital until it hopefully turns around.
I mean, how much of a big deal is this in the life of Comair? Because Comair it's been profitable ever since day one. It's been running for the last 70 years. It's never seen a loss in those, either a full year loss in those 70 odd years. It's a smartly run operation. R1 billion in the world of airlines is a lot to you and me, but when it comes to buying airplanes and stocking routes and stuff, it's not a huge amount of cash, is it?
Well, it's the value of a new aircraft. A new Boeing 737-800 costs about R1 billion. So to have one of those paid for you by SAA, I think is a
add insult to injury. Yes.
Yes, right. I think there's real pleasure in that for Eric Fenter. It is an airline that is incredibly tightly run. They squeeze the full value out of every cent that they've got. So R1 billion is really great. I haven't noticed or tracked the share price, but the 554 billion was actually awarded some years ago. So I would think that the actual benefit is already mostly in the stock price. But certainly, it must be a great relief to Eric Venter that the issue has finally been resolved and they've got a firm time framework for the actual payment of the money.
Yes. The question is whether SAA will be in business in 3 years' time and still paying that bill.
I have to say that I think it will. It's one of these great classics that actually may just be too big to fail. I cannot see our government being prepared to grasp the nettle of having a 10,000 employee organization go belly up on them. And the costs of the economy are significantly larger than the loss of just 10,000 jobs. You know, the SAA at this stage does provide important what we call connectivity to other places. It brings the world to Africa, takes Africa to the world. It makes South Africa a destination. Sure, there are arguments that the private sector will step in fairly smartly for that, do it better and more efficiently. But nonetheless, the fact of the matter is that for now, we've got SAA and Minister Gordhan has shown absolutely no signs of actually being prepared to wind it up. The most he's hoping for, and I think it is a possibility, a fair possibility, is that they will make it profitable in the next 2 years and be able to entice us, what they call a strategic equity partner, to buy in probably 25%, maybe even 50%, if they can change the laws.
At 20 to 4 this afternoon, the share price spiked up from under 5 Rand to 6 Rand and eventually closed up 22% on the day to 5 Rand 55, the Comair share price. Today's billion Rand, or just over a billion Rand settlement from SAA to Comair, worth half the value of the entire company at breakfast time this morning. It was a 2 billion Rand company at breakfast, and now they've just had, over the next 3 years, they'll have a billion Rand added to the balance sheet. And that is 50% of the value of the business. So it is a big deal in the life of Comair. Guy Leach, thank you very much indeed. From Cape Town, a managing editor of SA Flyer magazine.
The Money Show.
The markets.
If Solid Gold plays all the number ones, what would be the number twos be? Would they be like the worst songs from that year? That would be quite a fun thing to do, to play the number twos. Anyway, two fires around MTN today. Former South African ambassador to Iran, Yusuf Sulaji, has been charged with foreign bribery. 75-year-old, he appeared in the Johannesburg Specialized Commercial Crimes Court, released on 4,000 Rand bail. And it follows this long-running allegation that there was underhand activity in MTN winning the right to operate Iran's cell over the rival Turkcell. Turkcell had gone for the license, MTN went for the license, MTN got the license, and ever since then Turkcell has claimed foul play. And what's interesting today, that's seen that Yusuf Saluji appeared in the Commercial Crimes Court. There was another story this morning that the MTN Uganda chief executive, a guy called Wim Van Helpeter, has been deported from Uganda, hot on the heels of at least two other executives there as well. And that's on top of the troubles that MTN has got in Nigeria too. So massive headaches for the management team at MTN. Andrew Bryson is with Sunland Private Wealth. He's our market commentator this evening. He's in studio with us tonight. I mean, it's not going to weigh massively on MTN, which has already had investors so worried for the last 2 years that they've sold the share price way, way, way down, haven't they?
Yeah, Bruce, it just seems that they can't seem to get away from the negative press. And if you look at that share price, you know, even after the Nigerian, the recent issue they had there got settled, the price really hasn't recovered. And I think it is, you know, South African investors sort of looking more cautiously and saying, you know, they want some of these stories to settle down.
Well, stories that haven't settled down are stories around EOH, and EOH acknowledges as much, saying for the last 2 years it's been in the headlines for all the wrongs after being a market darling and an outperformer for years and years and years. Suddenly it sort of hit a brick wall, and lots of negativity around EOH. And then this week there was the bombshell that after 20 years Microsoft has decided to discontinue its relationship to allow the guys at EOH to sell MTN. To sell, what is the company called? Microsoft products, biggest company in the world. And they've lost the right to sell the Microsoft products in South Africa. They said it wasn't material and nobody believed them. And then today being forced to come out with quite a big sort of reassuring statement from the company.
Yeah, Bruce, I mean, the price was up today, although it's fallen substantially this week. They were saying in that sense that they are looking to work with Microsoft to sort of better understand why they're looking to cancel their contract. I think, you know, although it might not be substantial from earnings perspective, I think with all the negative, you know, sort of press around corporate governance at EOH, I think the markets are, you know, understandably quite nervous already.
Yeah, most certainly on. We've seen that share price come in. It started at $170 just a couple of years ago, down to below $20 today, and then R16 yesterday, back up to sort of close to 20 once again. So yeah, EOH trying to do some damage control on that particular front. Discovery, now we're not used to Discovery profits declining. It's been a long time since we've seen that, but they are investing heavily in new businesses, especially the bank. It's life business. We'll talk about the life business. Let's just talk about the fact that the profits are going to come under pressure. It is quite unusual for Discovery, isn't it?
Yeah, look, I mean, it's certainly one of the darlings of the South African market and one of the massive success stories on our market and sort of a brand that's been taken overseas now. They did come up with out with a weaker trading update, and from what I saw, it looked like there were one-offs that had an impact, including the bank that was recently launched, and then a spike in some life insurance claims. But otherwise, I think that, you know, the business prospects are still positive. I saw in that result the vitality portion of that business, which, you know, is the one that gets a lot of press. That's going from strength to strength, and that was up 180% year on year. I mean, that's still a very small part of Discovery, but I guess very much part of the brand and what people, you know, sort of recognize as core to that business.
I suppose the biggest concern in this Discovery trading update, and we'll see the detail of it in the results next week, is the fact that lots more rich people died. And I say lots more rich people died, it's because high premium paying customers. Suddenly there was a surge. The actuaries misread the numbers.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know. I guess these things happen, but I mean, as you say, I think, you know, unexpected and sort of, I guess in a period that was outside of the ordinary.
Yep. Well, we hope it's outside the ordinary. Otherwise, lots of rich people getting very frightened this evening, going, "Oh, there's an epidemic. We're dying." You and I will be fine, Andrew. Goldfields, they made a profit, but the profit's just like a fraction of what they made a year ago. The costs of digging gold out the ground, no matter where you're digging it out the ground, are rising and rising exponentially.
Yeah, well, certainly. I mean, and I think even more so in South Africa. I think South Africa, I mean, we saw Sibanye, I think, earlier than we coming out and talking about job losses on some of their marginal mines. In Goldfields' case, South Deep, that's been going through a large restructure, has been going through quite a costly exercise. And I think that sort of negatively impacted what was a better performance from some of the international operations.
And Pioneer, it was weird to see Pioneer talking about inflation in their basket of nearly 6%, where all the supermarkets have been reporting really, really low inflation figures. Pioneer's costs were high.
Yeah, so I think for the first time, but we are starting to see raw material costs pick up. And we saw that in the Pioneer trading update. I think they were saying they saw sort of cost push inflation coming in at about 5.8%. So certainly, you know, so some producer costs coming through there.
There's an awful lot to be said for boring companies. And I mean, at risk of insulting everybody who's ever worked for Mondi, it does qualify, I'm afraid, as a boring company. It just keeps on producing solid results. And ultimately, that's what you want from an investment, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't think this is a particularly boring company at all. I think, you know, Mondi coming out with a great set of results, earnings up, I think it was around 25%.
Say the results weren't exciting, but they make boxes for other people.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the world we live in these days, you know, with online deliveries, you know, that all comes in a box, and that was a market that wasn't necessarily around in the last sort of decade or so. So I think we are seeing, you know, some new growth areas in these packaging or paper companies.
Andrew Bryson with Sanlam Private Wealth on a day where the market ended nice and strong, best level so far this year. In fact, this week has been pretty good for markets. So first driven by the rapidly weakening currency, and then the currency steadied, but markets maintained their elevated levels. And it was, from an investor's point of view, not a bad week at all. Andrew Bryson at Sanlam Private Wealth. Thank you.
Show is brought to you by Nedbank. Looking at money from every angle leads to better money decisions. See money differently. Nedbank.
On the next Money Show, tune in for our regular business book fundy, Ian Mann. He's reviewing a book called The Fearless Organization, Creating Psychological Safety in the Workplace for Learning, Innovation and Growth by Amy Edmondson. You've got to have a courageous workplace, otherwise you simply don't evolve. Also, Make Money Monday's special edition guest, keep focused. You must be focused. Focus mit Freak. Freak Robinson is our veteran current affairs journalist here on Make Money Monday's special edition guest. We're going to be focused with Freak on Monday.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield. Live. Online. Smartphones. DSTV. And 92.7. And 106 FM.
Welcome to
FM.
The Money Show. And it's that time of the week where we bring you some of the best bits from the week that has been on The Money Show. And the week has been dominated, let's face it, with the horrors and the dread around load shedding. And just even the most optimistic of optimists have begun to get just a little battle weary. And thank goodness today, it looks like most people managed to dodge load shedding. It was a grim 4 days, though, after a bit of load shedding in December. We then sort of forgot about the fact that it existed, and it came back with a bang or with a whimper or whatever it was, but it came back, and it really wasn't welcome. And we sat with stage 4 load shedding at one point, and it was really, really scary and remains scary because simply the bills are big, the infrastructure is old, and the sticky gum and plasters and the sort of prit stick that they're using to stick the generating capacity with at the moment just isn't working adequately. And the top story this week was the load shedding. It caught so many sectors off guard, and we covered this extensively on The Money Show. But one of the more interesting chats we had around load shedding and its impact was with the chief economist at the Minerals Council of South Africa, Henk Langenhoven, explaining the cost of load shedding on the mining sector.
Well, you'll have to work out the daily production and then take 20% off that. We are a 600 billion industry, roughly. So divide that by 360 days or so on and multiply by 0.2. That'll give you an idea of the turnover. I can't tell you exactly the profitability and that sort of thing. But it's a disruption. It's a process. The best example to me is the chocolate factory. After you heated up that mixture, you have to pour it and you have to get it out of that machine, otherwise it goes all gooey. You can imagine a furnace full of iron ore that's melted and the power goes off. What do you do?
It's gooey. You don't want a gooey iron ore. Nobody wants gooey iron ore. But Henk Langenhoven at the Minerals Council explaining on a large scale in the corporate world what happens. But then, you know, in anecdotal discussions with dentists and Uber drivers and people run real businesses in the real world, coffee shop owners, biscuit makers, the cost of running generators and the cost of not having a generator and having to tell your customers, please, can you come back another time? We simply can't service you now. We don't know when we'll be able to. It was debilitating for many people. And a couple of estimates put the daily cost for the broader economy at about 3 billion rand. You know, how are you meant to grow at 2%? Never mind 3, 4 or 5% when you simply can't rely on the fact that when you plug your widget into the wall, whether or not it's going to function or not. And the blackouts also deflated the spirit of Wendy Alberts, the chief executive of the Restaurant Association of South Africa. The industry does really well, usually on Valentine's Day, and usually happy. But last night, the sector had just absolutely zero love for Eskom, and Wendy was really annoyed. She was unpacking the effect of the load shedding on the restaurant sector, especially yesterday, which was Valentine's Day.
The very sad thing is that, you know, people would have planned the Valentine's Day long before the load shedding schedule was put out there. So a lot of restaurants would have hosted a beautiful tasting menu, a five-course meal, a wine pairing, beautiful elements that go with the romantic notion of having the most perfect evening. And then Eskom unannounced puts this span in the works, which really has just caused a whole deficit in our restaurant industry. And a lot of restaurants had to close, turn away these bookings. They can't process orders on time. Their laundry can't be done because there's a knock-on effect with the laundries. They've got to do manual orders, which complicate things because the orders aren't processed properly. They need to get bigger staff in because they need to wash dishes. The staff are delayed.
All of that stuff that you would never consider in running a restaurant. And you pitch and then you go, oh, $150 for a main course. Are you people crazy? It's going to get more and more expensive. It really is, because restaurants are going to have to, if they want to stay in business, find ways are being a lot more creative with their menus and also being a lot more resilient when it comes to the vulnerabilities to the grid. Well, George Glenos, the head of research at ETM Analytics, is seething, absolutely spitting mad about the number of own goals we as a country keep scoring. And he's perplexed by those who think that Eskom is not too big and should not be split into three, as suggested by many experts and as committed to by the President in the State of the Nation address. And we've got to get the sense of we take three steps forward in terms of announcing proper policy and then two steps back as we try and mitigate the fallout within the tripartite alliance. No sooner did the President say we need to split this thing into three than we had the EFF and we had trade unions going, well, no, this is the first step towards privatization. You can't privatize. You can't do that. What should we do? Well, you can't do that. No solutions on the table, nothing feasible. And that's the problem with shouting from the sidelines. George Glenos is, lots of words you could use, but fed up is probably the most polite.
This idea that capitalists are just these greedy pigs that go out there to do everything off the back of laborers is just a complete and utter falsehood created by a very far left-leaning political entities to drum up support in a very populist way. It's nothing more than that, because there's no empirical evidence to suggest that anything they speak about holds any merit of truth whatsoever. In fact, quite the opposite holds true, where the more of the private sector you get included into these strategic assets, the more sustainable they are. And I can assure you right now that prioritizing 5,000 or 10,000 workers that may need to be laid off at Eskom over the opportunity costs through the rest of the economy by not having a sustainable and stable electricity grid is dwarfed many times over. Lest we forget, this economy can easily add 50,000 jobs plus in a quarter if the environment was one that was stable enough for them to do so. Choosing to rather remain interventionist than to continue to go down the road of nationalizing these strategic assets is exactly the wrong way to go, and it's exactly the reason why South Africa lands up in the very poor position that it's in right now.
Lots of anger, lots of rage, lots of logic, lots of illogical reactions to the tough decisions that have to be taken in order to bring the country back from the brink. And it is largely on the brink. If the grid goes down, we're all in trouble. Let's take a break from that, though, to sunnier stories. We had Abel Sithole, the principal executive officer of the Government Employees Pension Fund. He was this week's shapeshifter, and he spoke about the woes around the PIC and the GEPF's mandate. He also busted some really interesting myths about the Government Employees Pension Fund.
I think we must also correct what I think is not a correct notion that pension funds, including the GEPF, are not investing. Actually, most pension funds in South Africa already invest a significant amount.
And one of the great ironies, one of the great ironies is a lot of these pension funds are actually looking outside of the country because there aren't really investable assets in
South
country.
Africa, yes. So I think, yes, we should be doing more, but the truth of the matter is that your average pension in South Africa already has a portfolio that is 30% fixed income, and that
which is bonds, lending to corporates and lending to government.
And to government. So, yes, when people say lend more to government, it must be understood that pension funds are actually already doing that. So it's not as if they're not doing that.
Hand on your heart.
Yes.
Hand on your heart. Public sector pension safe?
Very much so.
Abel Sithole, lovely man. Another nice guy. I think he's a bit naughty. He's funny, certainly, and he's gifted, and he's very fast. Bruce Fordyce. I don't know why they call him Fordyce, because he won the Comrades 9 times. They should call him Nine Dice, because he diced so well so many times. But yes, he raced into our studios on Make Money Monday special edition. You must download the podcast, really, especially Make Money Monday. Some really great stories from people, household names. And he brought those Saturday morning social runs, the park run, to South Africa. He saw the opportunity, brought it to South Africa, and it's been an extraordinary success story. Founded by a guy who lived in South Africa and then did the first one in the United Kingdom. And we'll get hold of him at some point, too. I think he'd be a fabulous shapeshifter. One of the many things that Bruce Fordyce has done, of course. And here he tells us about his first paying job a very, very long time ago.
Okay, so my very first proper job was working for the sweatshop when I was a student in the holidays. Jack Snyman, who runs the sweatshop, in Joburg. I worked for him when it was in Melly Street. It was a hole in the wall, lovely place, Mecca for running. And I had a sort of holiday job there. And then what people may not know about me is I'm actually an ex-archaeologist. I studied and taught archaeology, and I specialized. I was heading on that direction in Bushman stroke San rock art with the world's leading genius in rock art, Professor David Lewis Williams. And I worked as a, first of all, research assistant, and then a research officer, and then unfortunately the running took off with live television coverage. So I can tell you that my first salary was as an archaeological research assistant, 800 rand a month.
I mean, I've not met that many archaeologists, but certainly never met a millionaire archaeologist or a billionaire archaeologist.
No, it's not like Raiders of the Lost Ark, not at all. And you don't dig up treasures like that, but you dig up more fascinating treasures in many ways. And people forget often that Africa is the birthplace of humankind. So we as a species came from here in the Rift Valley, or along there, the earliest hominid species. We have, without a doubt, the finest and most beautiful rock art all over the caves and shelters of the Drakensberg and the mountains all over southern Africa. Absolute gems, treasures. And I was actually the chairman of the committee that built the Origin Center at Griffith University, which is where there's quite a lot of rock art on display and explaining all about early culture and art and religious thinking.
Very talented and multifaceted Bruce Fordyce, our Make Money Mondays special edition guest. In a couple of minutes' time, it'll be time for the Friday evening edition of the Brutal Biz Quiz. And I've created a whole portfolio of sneaky and devious questions, which you'll get so easily if you've been paying attention during the week. I would like to know, please, which is Africa's biggest pension fund? I'd like you to name for me Africa's biggest pension fund on 021-446-0567, 011-883-0702. I thought we'd start easy and then ramp it up from there.
The Money Show.
The Brutal Biz Quiz.
Let's get ourselves a Wizard of the Biz Quiz this evening, shall we? Paul, tell me, please, which is Africa's biggest pension fund?
Government Employees Pension Fund.
The GEPF, absolutely. Defined Benefit Pension Fund, 1.2 million active members, 400,000 pensioners and beneficiaries, assets of more than 1.6 trillion rand. No wonder government wants to get its hands on the kitty, so to speak. The patent for which important device was filed on this day? It was yesterday, the 14th of February, 1875.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh, come on. Get a grip. Get a handle. you're going to kick yourself. I'm trying to get a clue to you, Paul, without giving it away completely. It'll ring a bell.
Bicycle.
No. You're going to hate yourself. You really are, Paul.
Oh, it's telephone.
No. Oh, all right. Okay. My producer's saying be nice to Paul. Yes, the telephone. But it was filed by Alexander Bell. The American inventor filed his application for the phone on the same day as Elisha Gray filed the application. Gray later withdrew his patent, but there's been lots of controversy for over a century over who actually invented it. Telephones and inventions, always trouble. What's the name? And I'm not giving you any more clues. All right. What's the name of the small private Dutch organization that received money from investors by claiming they'd take the first humans to Mars? And three. And two.
I don't have a clue. But sorry, Bruce.
No, don't apologize to me. Apologize to your friends, your family, and everyone who knows you. thank you for playing, Paul. Good fun. Oh, and Simon's gone. Simon doesn't want to play the game either. We spoke to the mad doctor, the mad scientist, who still wants to be amongst the first people who go to Mars on the one-way trip. So your question this evening is the Dutch organization that's been declared bankrupt. It had this big claim that it was going to take human beings to Mars and be the first ones there. What is the name of that organization? Let's try Sipiwe this evening.
The Mars One project.
It is Mars One, absolutely right. This week a court decision was settled to liquidate the organization, bankrupting it in the process. But Dr. Adriana Marais says, no. They'll find some funding. I think she's hoping they will. Which South African sportsman is responsible for growing Park Run in South Africa? You heard his voice just a few moments ago.
I forgot his name. He won about 9 Comrades Marathons. Nah, for God.
What's my name?
Bruce.
Yes, okay. What's his name?
That's Bruce.
The other Bruce. Not good enough, Sipiwe. Sorry. Zianda, who is the sportsman who brought Parkrun to South Africa?
Bruce Fordyce.
Bruce Fordyce, absolutely right. I would like to know, please, the following people all held which job at one point or another? Thulani Gcabashe, Jacob Moroka, Mpho Makwana, and Brian Dalmas, and a whole bunch of others. But those are just four of the people who held one particular job at various points. Thulani Gcabashe, Jacob Moroka, Mpho Makwana, Brian Dalmas, probably the most famous, most recent famous guy to hold that particular job.
He or MTN, I'm sure.
No, no, no. But we're not going to have enough time to get a whiz of the biz quiz. I need a whiz. I don't need a whiz, you understand. I just need a whiz of the biz quiz. Because if I needed a whiz, I couldn't be here. I wouldn't be able to concentrate. George.
Yeah, Bruce, it's Eskom.
Eskom, yeah. Chief Executives of Eskom. Since the year 2000, these men are part of a variety of leaders. The current Chief Executive is Phakamani Hadebe with a horrible job of switching the lights off, of course. Nobody wants to be. You've got one job. Your job is to keep the lights on, and then you have to switch them off. You are the whiz, George, of the biz quiz, the brutal biz quiz on a Friday night. Last question would have been, if we'd had time, to whom is Bill Gates married? And you would have told me he was married to Melinda, and then you would have been even whizzier. But that was enough, George, to make you the whiz of the biz quiz on this Friday night. Thank you, everybody, for playing. Thank you all for coming on board. Thank you for your company this week. I'm hoping next week is going to be a happier, more productive, less stressful, less time-consuming, angry week. We hold thumbs for that. Good night.